Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. This hour, we will show you how you can think like an inventor with the book Calling All Minds. We'll also help you think about the disintegration of the Seattle Seahawks. Please stay with us. First, our top story. The company that sends Canadian oil to Washington State wants to really open the spigot. The number of oil tankers passing the San Juan Islands would increase nearly sevenfold if this pipeline expansion goes through. Over the weekend, thousands of people rallied in Vancouver to stop that from happening. Here is Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hi, Vaughn.
Hello, Bill.
An anti-pipeline rally and a pro-pipeline rally, too.
Yeah, well, the anti is what? Was it 20 to 1?
Yeah.
In terms of attendance, about 5,000 people at the anti, 250 people at the pro.
Mm-hmm.
The public opinion in British Columbia is more closely balanced than that. Depending on where you live, it averages out about 50-50 across the province. A little more support for the pipeline than against. But where it's distributed is what matters. The area where the tankers will be coming and going, Vancouver Island, the city of Vancouver and around there, it's a little more anti, and in the north and the interior of the province where the pipeline will actually be built, a lot more support for it. And of course, if they ever do build it, the construction jobs will mostly be up there as well.
The pipeline already exists. The oil is flowing already to Washington State refineries, so why the big outcry?
That's right. There's a big pipeline that comes all the way from Alberta. It's been there since the 1950s. And east of Vancouver, it splits into two pipelines. One comes to a refinery in a suburb of Vancouver. The other one goes down and feeds the refineries in Washington State. So Anacortes, Ferndale, Cherry Point. And I think, in fact, there's a spur line goes all the way to the refinery in Tacoma. So the oil has been coming for a long time. The idea of twinning the pipeline is the controversial. And they want to twin the pipeline, not the spur line that goes to the States, but just into Vancouver, and they want to export that oil out of Vancouver. So right now, about five tankers a month, oil tankers a month, leave Vancouver. Some of them go to Tacoma, some of them go to Asia. That would increase, as you say, sevenfold. So it would be about 34 a month, one a day. That is about how many tankers go by Victoria every month from Alaska going to Washington State. So the tanker traffic would be balanced, but it would be a two-way tanker traffic. And everybody says the more tankers you have, the greater the likelihood of an accident.
And that's a big part of the environmental argument, obviously. There's also a legal claim here. Would you mind summarizing the First Nation legal claim?
British Columbia's First Nations, Native people, most of the province was settled without treaties, therefore they have unresolved title to the province. They have often inserted that in court, as you can't go ahead and develop things within their land, within their traditional territory, without their approval. They are asserting that claim in various ways, threatening to block construction. They've been in court already. We're awaiting one decision on that. They will likely be back in court again. So it's a very large, unresolved legal constitutional issue.
So we mentioned the concerns about spills, the First Nations claim, and of course there's the climate change argument, keep it in the ground. But what would happen if this project, if this pipeline were not, as you say, twinned, if it were not expanded, would the oil be kept in the ground?
No, it wouldn't. I mean, it would just, you know what happens, right? I mean, the United States blocked the Keystone Pipeline from Canada, but the last time I checked, oil production in the United States has jumped from 4 million barrels a day to 10 million barrels a day since Obama became president. So that's what, 250% increase in production? No, I mean, I don't think that stopping this one pipeline is going to do that. There certainly is an issue with marine safety, but even there, our national government is promising to spend more than $1 billion on resources to improve tanker protection on the coast and to provide resources for cleanup. So they're saying, they've approved the pipeline, that it would be safer in these waters if we let the project go ahead, because all of that additional resources for prevention and cleanup are tied to approval of the pipeline going ahead.
So the oil would go to our coast by train instead of pipeline?
That's another point, Bill. You know, you've already got a spur line going into Cherry Point with from Bakken. There's a big argument about this. The pipelines are safer than rail transport. And, you know, I think a lot of the opposition in British Columbia is not to the pipeline. It's to the idea that the oil's going to go from the pipeline to tankers overseas. If they were increasing oil shipments to the West Coast to a new refinery in Vancouver or sending even more of it to Washington State to be refined down there, I don't think there'd be the same level of opposition. It's the tankers that really has galvanized opposition here in British Columbia. And it's just the concern that even one Exxon Valdez is too many.
Finally, Vaughn, is this just a Canadian debate? Do you know whether anybody in the U.S. and here in Washington State would have a legal claim since an oil spill could
spread? Well, they certainly have a claim for cleanup, but, yeah. You know, when Cherry Point got built in 1971, as I said, there's, I think, about 500 tankers a year go into that from Alaska and Ferndale and so forth. The Canadian government wasn't all that happy about it, but the tankers go through U.S. waters and international waters, so there's no question of stopping it. There are protocols, there are safety measures, there's coordination on both sides of the border, but I don't think the United States could stop this if Canada decides to go ahead. I think they could insist on cleanup and all of that and prevention, but I think that's going to be written into the contracts anyway.
We're talking about the expansion, the twinning of the Kinder Morgan pipeline, a project that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau supports, along with a couple of hundred people over the weekend in Vancouver, but dwarfed by the much larger 5,000-person protest over the weekend. And we'll keep following this for you with Vaughn Palmer, columnist with the Vancouver Sun. Thanks a lot, Vaughn.
Stay in touch, Bill.
We'll
talk
do.
To you soon.
We'll do. And tomorrow on this program, what is Mayor Durkan's plan on homelessness, crime, parking, housing, arresting protesters, taxing businesses? Yes, Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan is going to be on this show tomorrow, and I will put your question to her. So post it now on KUOW's Facebook page. It's there right now on our Facebook page. Tune in tomorrow then at noon for Mayor Durkan on KUOW's The Record. The well-known animal behavior expert Temple Grandin was just 16 years old when she invented what became known as the hug machine.
When I got into puberty, I started having horrendous panic attacks. And I was out at my aunt's ranch, and they were working some cattle on the next-door neighbor's ranch. And I noticed that when they put him in the squeeze chute, which is a device to hold a wild calf still while he gets his vaccinations, that some of the calves kind of calmed down. So I built kind of a squeeze chute device that I could get into. It was modeled after a cattle chute. You know, for certain individuals, the deep pressure is calming.
For coming up with the hug machine, also known as the squeeze machine, Temple Grandin credits her inventor brain. And now she's written a new book, Calling All Minds, How to Think and Create Like an Inventor. I asked Grandin what it means to think like an inventor.
Well, an inventor takes ideas and puts them together. My grandfather was the co-inventor of the autopilot for airplanes. He worked with a man named Andrew Nikian, who came up with a very simple idea for three coils to go in the wing of the plane to measure the magnetic field. And this was prior to World War II, and everybody was trying to make the compass for the autopilot by hooking the regular needle compass up to the plane's controls. That was a total mess. The plane would gyrate all over the place. And everybody thought the Andronikian coil was just rubbish. And my grandfather got a hold of that, and he goes, you know, I can make that work. And he spent years tinkering with it in a loft over a trolley car repair place in Springfield, Massachusetts, and they couldn't get it to work. And then they realized that the big metal train cars, you know, like 5 feet underneath his workbench, were affecting how the compass works. So then he got out in the field and he got it to work. But lots of times invention takes a lot of tinkering. It also takes the idea of changing totally how you do something. In aviation, they tried to originally make airplanes flap their wings. That was a mistake.
Uh-huh. You can understand the impulse.
Well, let's take something like the artificial heart. Well, who says it has to beat? I mean, the Jarvik heart was a great big kind of a big mess. Well, you can just use a little rotary pump.
Yes.
Doesn't have to beat.
Yes.
You see, that's where you have to think of a different way of looking at inventing something.
Questioning natural assumptions, understandable assumptions, but, you know, there could be a new way.
Well, the only reason the heart has to beat is because the only way you can make a pump out of muscle is something that beats. If it's a mechanical device, it can just be a rotating pump. It doesn't have to beat.
So your grandfather had the mind of an inventor?
Oh, definitely. He was an MIT-trained engineer.
What was it about your grandfather that could
see past
that?
He could just see that he could make it work. And I did a similar thing with the center track restrainer conveyor system. The original research on that was done at the University of Connecticut, and they showed that having the animal straddle the conveyor was a low-stress way to handle it. But they were light years away from anything that would actually work in a plant. So I took a little plywood model, and I figured out how to make it work in a plant. I had to design an entrance design that would work. I had to design a way to make adjustable sides on it, make the whole thing work in the actual plant.
I'm a terrible inventor, Temple. I don't have the patience. I'm not filled with wonder about how this is going to turn out. I wonder what's the difference between how inventors like you think and non-inventors think.
Well, I'm a total visual thinker. I see it in my mind. And when I was young, I didn't know my thinking was different. So my very first work that I did with livestock, I got down in the chutes to see what cattle were actually seeing. You know, they'd stop at a reflection. They'd stop at a vehicle parked alongside the fence. They'd stop at a coat on the fence or a chain hanging down. Little things that we tend to not notice. And I didn't know at the time other people didn't think visually the way I do. And maybe one of the reasons why you're a radio person is because one time I was at a radio station and the lady who interviewed me said, I used to be in TV and I hated it because I didn't know what to do with the pictures. And she was a total verbal thinker. And in my book, The Autistic Brain, I discussed the different kinds of thinking. I am a photorealistic visual thinker. When I design something, I see the whole thing in my mind. Absolutely couldn't do algebra. Mm-hmm. Some of these draconian algebra requirements are screening out a lot of visual thinkers. Then you have the pattern mind, the pattern thinker, chemists, material science, origami, all of those kind of things. It's pattern thinking. That's your mathematicians. These kids often have trouble with reading. Then you have your verbal thinkers, and maybe that's why you're in radio, because you don't have a lot of pictures in your mind. And then there's other people, maybe dyslexic, really good at talking, going to be great in selling investors on a project. See, this is where you need to have the different kinds of minds.
So maybe my verbal mind, maybe I could be an inventor. I suppose I invent ways of putting things, ways of writing or saying things.
Well, ways of writing is a different kind of thinking. You see, the kind of stuff I do is mechanical invention. And the world needs to have us visual thinkers. Let's look at the big mess at Fukushima. That was a visual thinking mistake so colossal I can't believe they made it. There's no way I can design a nuclear power plant. But maybe I need to work on the safety systems, because the reason why it melted down is they failed to put watertight doors in to protect the electrically driven pump in the basement. The emergency cooling pump was put in a non-waterproof basement. That's a mistake I would never make. All I need to know about that emergency cooling pump, if it doesn't run when I need it, we are in a ton of trouble. And I've been thinking about self-driving trucks and some other things. They think they're going to get rid of all the people riding in the trucks. I don't think so. How about theft? You've got a really expensive vehicle out there.
Unguarded.
And you're going to send that across country unguarded?
Uh-huh.
I could see some short runs maybe not being manned. But going all the way across the country, you might have a $250,000, $500,000 vehicle. Maybe you got a load of iPhones in it. You're going to send that across the country unguarded? I don't think so.
So you're visualizing, you're seeing what the criminal sees.
Well,
the
yeah,
unguarded.
And I'm also, being a visual thinker, I'm thinking how I can really mess up the sensors. I'll make that truck stop in the middle of nowhere somewhere. I'll know how to beat the sensors. I'll make that truck stop and pull off the road.
Yes. You said the world needs visual thinkers.
Yes,
do you feel
do.
Like we underappreciate that?
I'm afraid a lot of visual thinking kinds of kids are getting screened out by the algebra requirement because we need them in the skilled trades. Recently, I went out to two very big pork processing plants that were recently built in 2017. We do not know how to make a lot of that equipment that goes in a pork processing plant. And that equipment is imported, and it's coming from countries that have a very strong skilled trades. I went down to the big poultry show. and the Italians are taking over the poultry processing stuff. One of the reasons for that is when kids are 4 and 5 years old, they're learning how to make things with tools. So we've got kids growing up today that are not doing anything with tools.
Why are we not giving kids tools? I got to admit, I don't put a lot of tools in my kids' hands.
Well, we got kids growing up to 14, 16 years old and still building things with Legos. Well, we need to be having kids doing things with tools. Who's going to fix bridges? I was in Detroit recently. You've got bridges falling apart with all the rebar showing. You know, I spent 25 years working in construction because I would sell a job, design it, supervise its construction, and then get it started up. And I worked with a lot of brilliant, quirky metal workers that were either autistic, stutterers, dyslexics, and these were big, complicated projects. And now the kid that ought to be building his things is playing video games in the basement instead of, figuring out how to invent, mechanical devices.
Is there a connection between the inventor's mind and the autistic mind?
Well, I think there's a lot of these guys are quirky guys. I went and looked up a biography of Thomas Edison, and he memorized every street in his town. And he was described as a hyperactive, addled high school dropout. What would happen to him today? Steven Spielberg was dyslexic, lousy student, got rejected from a top film school. You know what saved him? His little Super 8 movie camera. And that's getting the person introduced to career interests at an early age. I'm an Easterner originally, so how did I get interested in the cattle industry? I was exposed to it when I was a teenager.
And Steven Spielberg had a tool where he could make his own thing without anybody stopping him or telling him he couldn't, and he could show the finished result.
Right.
But he got there his way.
And if he hadn't had the Super 8 movie camera, mm-hmm. he probably wouldn't have gone into film.
Yeah. So when you write this new book coming out, Calling All Minds, about how to think and create like an inventor, are you calling for us, for society, to appreciate a quirky mind in a new way?
Well, the quirky minds invent a lot of things. I've been out to Silicon Valley. You've got all kinds of guys out there in the programming department that I know are on the autism spectrum. I've worked with all kinds of millwrights that were kind of quirky. Let's look at some of our creative people, some of these famous musicians that have recently passed away. Oh, I went and I looked up on David Bowie. I bought the whole special issue on him. Oh, weird man. You know, really different.
And did you think, David Bowie, autistic?
Well, I didn't say that. You buy the whole big magazine about him, and I'll let you make your own decision. But if we got rid of all of the autism, you got rid of all of the bipolar, we'd have a very boring world. You see, a little bit of that autistic trait can give you a musician, an inventor. You get too much of that trait, and then you get someone who can't dress themselves. Bipolar, in the family histories of people that are bipolar, you'll have more creative musicians and artists and creative writers. Too much of the trait, the person's not able to function. If you totally got rid of all of this genetics, and it's going to be complicated genetics. It's not going to be simple. I'm right now participating in a big genome. I had my entire genome scanned and put through artificial intelligence. And the Lineagen found out why I've got little, small, ugly teeth and why my skin is horrible and things like that. My hair is thin. It explains that. But the autism's too complicated.
Why did you want to know about your genetics?
Well, I went to visit the place, and they left this little vial out on the counter, and I spat in it. Also, I like to explore inner space, too. I've also tried out all the latest brain scanning things that are not available. And I found out I've got a really big visual thinking circuit, and I've got a little thing full of water where the algebra department ought to be.
Do you feel any differently about yourself from that
knowledge?
Well,
I always thought that my skin and my teeth were built by a really shoddy home developer. You know, I when I lived in Arizona, they had a home developer there that built really cheap, awful houses that just fell apart. Well, that's sort of like I found out genetically now from this very fancy genomics test that, yes, my skin and my hair and my nails was built by a really shoddy home developer. But you know what? It hasn't told me too much about the autism. You see, because I think that genetics is so diffuse. You see, I think some of this is normal variation. A brain can be more cognitive or a brain can be more social-emotional. And there's a certain range of this which is normal variation. And the genetics is vastly more complicated than why I have small teeth. I found out why I have small teeth. There's a mutation that caused that.
Well, the funny thing is, you're telling me about your shoddy body with a twinkle in your eye and a smile on your face.
Well, I like finding out about things, you know, looking for knowledge. I always like looking for knowledge. And some of the most funnest stuff I ever did in my life was working in construction, and we had to figure out how to build things, how to invent things.
You describe inventors as having different ways of thinking. Could any of us be an inventor if we would just recognize the way we invent and elevate
that? One of
the
things in invention is where you really get a breakthrough is where you take an idea from something else. Like when I was a little kid, my bird kite flew because I made it out of textured art paper. And I can't get that paper easily now. So I started looking up other textured things. This is going to be really fun for kids. Why does a dimpled golf ball fly further than a smooth one?
Right.
Or you can look at the scalloped pattern on the back of the engine housing on the Boeing Dreamliner. And I went and I looked up the patents on this, and there were all different kinds of shapes for this that people experimented with to reduce the noise that the airplane makes. You know, these are really fun things to invent with. You can also have things where you get a totally different way of looking things. Let's look at that Blade Runner leg. For amputees, that's the Blade Runner foot or the cheetah foot. That's something that's totally, completely different. That's an example of getting away from how a person would do it. That would be the same thing as deciding in aviation maybe the wings of the plane don't need to flap. But there's some things that planes have, birds have. When birds land, they'll put their slats down just like a jet does. Put their slats down, and the way their tail works has got similarities. So they didn't totally take away all the bird stuff.
So do you think that an inventor is a born inventor? Or do you think if we recognize the way each of us think, we could take advantage of that mode and become an inventor?
Well, I think some people can become an inventor. But kids need to have a lot of different things to tinker with. I think robotics is really good. But I think it's kind of ridiculous for them to have $20,000 robots. They ought to be figuring out how to make it out of bicycle chains and forklift pallet pieces and maybe buy the electronic components and just figure out how to make it out of a bunch of junk to kind of tax their creativity on making it. But we've got kids growing up today that don't know how to hold a hammer. I went to a little nursery school at Northwest Missouri where 3 and 5-year-olds are using screwdrivers and they're screwing up little nuts and bolts and they're making robots out of broken computer pieces and getting really introduced to tools. And we've got kids today, growing up today, that don't do anything with their hands. They don't cook, sew. Now, I think there's getting to be some new interest in these things. But the other thing about these hands-on jobs, these are not going to get replaced by artificial intelligence. You know, somebody that can build things really well. Okay, I stay in a lot of hotels. There's some big pumps. If those big pumps don't work, I ain't going to have any water in the top floor of that hotel. Somebody's got to fix that stuff. Somebody has to build that stuff. People forget that. That stuff's not going away.
Temple Grandin, you make discovering our inventor brains sound so much fun.
Oh, that's a lot of fun. I spent hours tinkering with my bird kites. Then I made parachutes out of scarves, and I spent hours tinkering with little crossbars to keep the strings from tangling. Lots and lots of tinkering. The project is going to be in the books, and I want to warn you, kids, you're going to need to do some tinkering. I got the bird kites to fly, but they need some of the different rough surfaces put on them because rough surfaces do good things aerodynamically if you do it right.
Do you light kids up when you talk like this about inventing?
Oh, yes. And you know what? Kids think visually, because when I talk to children about cattle behavior and I talk about the animal seeing a reflection, seeing a puddle, seeing the hose on the ground, the chain hanging down, the coat on the fence, and I've got a slide that I show that shows a steer looking directly at a sunbeam. When I show that to grown-ups, I might get 5% of the hands in the audience going up. When I show that elementary school children, half the hands go up.
What do they say?
Well, they see it. See, little kids are much more visual. We need to value our visual thinkers, and I'm concerned that some of these very rigid requirements are screening them out. But we need our visual thinkers to prevent messes like Fukushima, to figure out how to do a whole lot of really exciting things. because I don't understand a lot of computer stuff, but all this computer stuff, things like the self-driving truck, that has to interface with the real world. That I understand. That sensor, whatever it does, even if it's radar or something, it still has to interface with the real world. That I understand.
Temple Grandin, thank you for putting all this into words that my brain can understand. It's great to talk with you.
Great to be here.
Temple Grandin, well-known animal behavior specialist, and her new book is coming out in May. It's called Calling All Minds, How to Think and Create Like an Inventor. We're going to pick up with more of KUOW's The Record in just a moment. Stay tuned. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Former Seattle Seahawk Richard Sherman. Sorry about that, 12s. Former Seahawk Richard Sherman is now San Francisco 49er Richard Sherman. And if you went out of town for the weekend, you might have missed the whole thing. Cut by Seattle on Friday afternoon, Sherman negotiated a new contract by himself and signed with San Francisco the next day. Reporter Michael Sean Dugar covers the Seahawks for SeattlePI.com, explains the Seahawks here on KUOW. Good to see you again.
All right. Always happy when you guys have me.
Richard Sherman's a 49er. You mad, bro?
I'm happy for him.
Yeah.
We like to use terms like cut and released because those are the official like terms or part ways, which is weird. Uh-huh. I mean, this is getting fired. Richard Sherman was fired.
The Seahawks fired Richard Sherman?
Yeah, he was fired from his job. The checks don't come in anymore. You clean out, get your bag, give you a little box where you put all your flour in and your pictures of your wife and kids. Yeah, you're fired. When you get fired, that hurts. I've been fired. It sucked. So, I mean, I can, and if I had a chance to go back to where I was fired from and then, like, stick it to them, yeah, I probably would, too.
To them meaning the Seahawks are going to play the 49ers at least twice a year.
Oh, it's not a coincidence that that's the first meeting he took and the only meeting he took.
Really? You think you wanted to go to the 49ers to taunt and haunt Russell Wilson and Pete Carroll?
I think he was open to the idea. I think he was open to a bunch of other teams, obviously, right? But, I mean, it came out just, I think, this morning, like, yeah, he admitted the Niners offered something like the Raiders of Detroit, and no one else could really offer the chance to come back to Seattle and play well and ball out in front of the teammates. I think he's fine with those guys. They didn't fire him. Russell didn't fire him. No, it's the team who said take less money, and he's like, wait, no. It's like, I'm going to go somewhere else, and you're going to regret it.
So the Seahawks just wanted him to take less money. Do you think, because he had some fires burned while he was here. He yelled at his own coaches. Mm. Is that a factor, do you think?
I don't think so.
Okay.
No, I don't. I think that, that does matter. Like, you can't just tell the coach what he should do, right? He's the coach or the player for the reason. But Pete Carroll's kind of built that environment. And even though sometimes it may seem like it's come to, back to bite him a little bit, it is what made the Seahawks this, like, dominant force that they are today, right? So it's you live and die by it. So that's I think they kind of accepted that culture, in that regard. I don't think it's just like, oh, let's get the loudmouth out of here. I don't think that's the case with Michael Bennett either.
Well, we'll get to Michael Bennett too, but speaking of loudmouth, Richard Sherman did taunt a 49er in the playoffs, but they're over that. They don't hate him for that.
I mean, they're going to have to figure it out really, really quick if they are. I think he said today that he's going to unblock all the 49ers fans he had blocked on Twitter. I think what he should do is he should, like, find all those bad tweets and just read them. Just kind of get it all out there, because I don't think they hated any member of the Seahawks more than they hated Richard Sherman. Like, he, if you remember in 2014 when he has the tip against the Niners up here, that ends them.
The end of their season.
They go 8-8 the next year, though. They fire their coach after that.
True.
And there's just downward spiral. Now, like, their best season since then has really been going 6-10.
Right.
He ended them. He destroyed them.
And he taunted them.
Yeah. Now he's part of the rebuild. Like, it's funny how that works.
I mentioned he did this by himself. He got a new deal with the 49ers with no agent. How did he do for himself? How did Richard Sherman pull that off? How did he do well
as
his own agent?
As the contract expert that I've become over the past 48 hours, I can say that I think he did pretty well. Right, I've read a contract before. Usually I'm reading, like, college coach contracts, right? That's where I was last at. But, I mean, legalese is tough, man. You can't just go in there and just kind of look at like tweets of like, oh, this cornerback got 5 years, $40 million. This other one got 3 years, blah, blah, blah. So I should get this. Like, no, no, no. You need to understand a lot more about the market and your value, how teams operate, how the taxes are going to work in the state that you're, you know, thinking about playing in, the philosophies of the team. You got to have a lot of understand a lot of stuff, and you need to know how to negotiate. You know, I just went car shopping last month and went to like 10 different dealerships. Man, that stuff is hard. Like, you need to know how to bargain.
But does it seem like Richard Sherman ended up being good at all that stuff or bad at all that stuff?
I think the way he got the deal, where it's basically he protects the team and he protects he kind of bets on himself. It's like, all right, well, the 49ers structured the deal where, all right, if he comes back off this Achilles and he sucks, we're kind of all right still financially. And it's like, well, if he comes back off the Achilles and he's great, we pay him what he's worth, and we're good, and we go beat the Seahawks.
Because he's not making so much immediately, but if he's in the Pro Bowl, if the 49ers make the playoffs, he makes out huge.
Yeah, he's got a bunch of incentives in there. He's got incentives for just being active on game day. You know,
active on game day? You mean?
Yeah, because they only have 53 players on the roster, active roster. 46 actually only suit up.
So active meaning not hurt, like on the field.
Yeah, active like you actually suit up in your uniform and your cleats and go out there. He gets money each week just for doing that. Like, those are the type of bonuses he has in there.
One more Richard Sherman question for you. How good is he still? He's been hurt a little bit. Is he going to torment Russell Wilson when those teams meet? Is he going to, you know, be a force?
There was a game, I think, a couple years ago where Aaron Rodgers went the entire game without throwing at Richard Sherman's side. I think that was here after they won the Super Bowl, if I'm not mistaken.
Packers.
Yes. Right? Yeah. That wouldn't surprise me if Russell Wilson did something similar. I mean, Sherman is good.
Yeah.
If he's even just a little bit of just like what he was, you know, before that injury, like, he was probably going to make the Pro Bowl again. Even if he was like even close to that, yeah, it's going to be a tough day for the Seahawks when they play the 49ers, man. The dude is still good. He's still one of the best cornerbacks in the league when healthy. It's just that when healthy kind of qualifier is the huge question.
And entertaining, too. We're going to miss him. And we're talking about the unrecognizable Seahawks with SeattlePI.com's Michael Sean Dugar, co-host of the Man to Man podcast. So Richard Sherman to the 49ers, and the Seahawks traded defensive end Michael Bennett to Philadelphia. Was that because he sat down during the national anthem?
I don't like to think so. I don't believe so. I don't get that vibe.
Can I play a quick quote for you and see what you think of this? This is some national sports radio guy quoting some other sports writer.
According to Albert Breer, three different offensive coaches called Michael Bennett, and this is their words, a pain in the ass. This is the NFL's most tolerant progressive team now admitting, yeah, that whole political thing in the locker room did not work.
You actually know these players, Michael. Is this an anti-politics backlash in any way, you think?
I don't believe so, no. I mean, I'm in the locker room every day. Not every day. I think Tuesdays I'm not. But, like, for the most part, like, I'm in there. I'm talking to guys on and, you know, off the record. I mean, I get the optics of it. That's an easy narrative to run with, right? I mean, Michael Bennett's book is called Things That Make White People Uncomfortable. Then white people ship them out of town. I get it. Like, it looks bad, like, when you put it that way. But I think the Seahawks, as the national guy said, like, they're a pretty tolerant team. And I think how this team operates is, it's not even about age, it's not about political stance for the most part. You just need to be productive relative to your price tag. You know, whether you're 25, 35, I mean, they signed Dwight Freeney, he's 37. You know, I don't think, like, there's a lot of factors that they've kind of consider when they bring in a guy. But it's like, are you good enough for what we're paying you? Like, we're trying to win here. Like, kneel, do whatever. I mean, Doug Baldwin, he's down there fighting to get laws changed. You know, he's outspoken about political views, right? And he's still on the team.
He's still on the team.
Paid pretty well, too. Like, I don't think it has – I think those are – you can run with it because it sounds good, right, and it fits. But I'm in there a lot. I've talked to the guys. I don't get that vibe at all.
So, Michael, Seattle's just traded two of the more interesting guys in the team. Would you rather have a winning team or an interesting team?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I'd go with the interesting team, like, whether they're winning or losing. Like, I would selfishly want to cover, like, the Portland Jailblazers, that bad, you know, or like I'm really upset I wasn't here when Marshawn Lynch was here drag racing against someone outside the facility, you know, or Bruce Irvin. Like, I'm selfishly sad Michael Bennett, Richard Sherman's gone. Those guys are fun. They talk. I like it. You know, we need that, you know.
Do you think the Seahawks did that on purpose? Were they that either entertaining or political on purpose, or and now their philosophy's changed, or is this just, these are just things that happen?
I think Pete Carroll's aware of that. Like, I think he's okay with that being, you know, the culture that he has kind of created. You know, remember, he came from USC where they weren't just like this boring college. There was a, there were stars down there, man, and they built stars up here, and they were, they're welcome to, they welcome the celebrity aspect of the players. You know, the quarterback is married to a pop star, you know, and she's there at the facility. Drake's been at practice. Kendrick Lamar was there the second day of training camp. You know, they're willing to build the stars and the personalities and build it up, because I mean, at the end of the day, in the NFL, you could do whatever, man. If you win, it that's it. You just got to win. Everyone just wants to win because everyone gets paid, and everyone's happy. Everyone's a celebrity and everyone eats.
Okay, then final question, prediction. Seahawks this season.
Which one? Record? Which
record?
Super Bowl. That's I say they probably get to 11 wins.
11 wins.
Yeah, I think they can get to 11 wins. And in the NFL, you just need to. It's all about like decreasing your margin of error, like how often the mistakes are going to affect your bottom line. And some of that is just like a kick here, a first down here, a tackle here, a play there. And with the way that Seahawks are structured, that's why I don't like to call it a rebuild. They still have the philosophies in place. That run the ball and stop the run, don't give up big plays. If that's your philosophy and you can execute it, you lower your margin for error and you can be successful.
Michael Sean Dugard, reporter at SeattlePI.com, co-host of the Man to Man podcast. No Richard Sherman, no Michael Bennett. Less interesting, 11 wins. Not a bad trade-off, according to a lot of fans, I'll bet. Good to see you again, Michael Sean. Thank you.
Always appreciate it.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. Back in a moment. The Record on KUOW Seattle. Thanks for tuning in. Alex Blum dreamed of joining the elite Army Rangers, and he did at age 18. And then 4 months later, right before his first deployment to Iraq, Alex and some friends robbed a Bank of America in Tacoma. That reversal from military man to criminal made Alex's cousin Ben so curious that he wrote a book about it, and it's called Ranger Games, a story of soldiers, family, and an inexplicable crime. Ben Blum spoke with KUOW's Jeannie Yandel.
It was a takeover-style robbery. There were four guys inside the bank, two of them with AK-47s, two of them with pistols. Alex was the driver, and he was arrested shortly afterward to the utter shock and horror of our entire extended family. I spent the next 7 years or so trying to figure out how this guy that I'd known as a goody-two-shoes growing up, a very patriotic, idealistic kid, had gotten involved in something so utterly uncharacteristic, ending his lifelong dream in a flash. So Ranger Games is the story of trying to figure that out, and it took a lot of twists and turns along the way.
When you first decided you wanted to look deeper into what your cousin Alex did, what did you expect to find?
Well, the story that he first told us was that the Rangers, their job is to take down buildings, small facilities, and they, in order to practice those skills, would constantly run little thought experiments around Tacoma. They'd go into a Dairy Queen, they'd ask, you know, where are we, where's our infill? Where are we going to be entering this facility through? What are the red zones, places where we might be coming under enemy fire? And the plans for the bank robbery appeared to him as just another training exercise. So he told us that right up until the moment of the crime, he thought he was just engaged in the further process of gaining the skills he needed to survive in Iraq right before his first deployment. So when I first went into the project, I really thought of it as an effort to clear my cousin's name. I felt that he had been duped and manipulated by a charismatic superior, Specialist Summer, into participating in this crime, and that he had served prison time unfairly.
Well, you talked with the ringleader, this charismatic Luke Summer. What did you learn from him? What were those conversations like?
So Summer had a very different take on the robbery. He, after the robbery, claimed that he had staged the whole thing to gain a platform to protest war crimes that he'd witnessed in Iraq and Afghanistan. After that, he became involved in a whole host of other crimes, including trying to put a hit out on his own prosecutor. By the time that I began talking to him, he was medicated for bipolar disorder and told me that he'd completely transformed, that he now saw that what he'd done was crazy and he was a different person. And according to him, he had not manipulated Alex. Alex had willingly gotten involved in this plan, knowing that it was indeed a real bank robbery, and that was it. End of story. But Summer is notorious for making up stories, and in talking to him, I began to understand that he was certainly making up a lot of what he was telling me about. He claimed to have been a super hacker as a teenager. He'd written this whole memoir about his teenage super hacker career that increasingly seemed to be made up. And there were numerous other inconsistencies in what he was saying. So I had to weigh these two, in some ways, equally implausible stories against each other, one from my cousin, one from Summer.
Why wasn't it enough to just listen to the story that your cousin Alex had to tell about that robbery and have that be enough?
Right. In the beginning, that was my approach. I felt that my role was to support this guy that I knew and loved and that had suffered enormously for this crime. It ended his career and his dream and his relationship with the girlfriend he wanted to marry. I mean, it was a huge disruption. And I also believed him. He was telling what sounded to me like the truth, and very earnestly. He was really looking inside himself, trying to understand how this could have happened and what the nature of his role really was. So that was my approach for the first 2 years or so. But as I continued to gather evidence from other places, I started coming across more and more hints that there might have been another story lying beneath the one that Alex was telling me. I wasn't sure whether it was buried beneath all the trauma and just inaccessible to him, like, you know, memory is notoriously unreliable when it comes to traumatic events, or whether there was something more willful going on. But Summer seemed to be my best chance of getting another glimpse at the nature of the relationship between him and Alex. It's really within that kind of deeply complex nuance of their relationship that the truth lies about how Alex came to be involved.
And I want to talk a little bit about what you did with those two conflicting stories that you had, but I want to get a little bit into that idea of trauma that you just brought up. From my reading of the book, it seems like Alex was pretty traumatized by his training to become a ranger, and that helped, if nothing else, kind of connect him better with Luke Summer. Is that right?
The training these guys go through is pretty extreme. That was what got me interested in Alex's story in the first place. He wrote an account of his training and of the Ranger Indoctrination Program, which isn't so much a training course as a selection process, that stunned me, both with its reflectiveness and with the extremity of what he'd gone through. So I was immediately sympathetic to the idea that he had undergone a radical change in personality after going through this radical training. It's an initiation ritual. It's designed to help soldiers cohere with each other and to separate them from the world that they came from before. But there's no question that that experience changed him radically and opened him to the possibility of a deeply trusting, loyal relationship with superiors, with any superior, anyone who fit the template of the guys he was taught to respect and follow when he went through that process, and Summer fit the bill. But at the same time, you know, I think as civilians, we are so hesitant to step outside the trauma paradigm in understanding what soldiers go through. And that ended up being a real limitation in how I approached Alex's story. I think I was very hesitant to try to hold him accountable in any way for parts of what he did wrong that he didn't seem to be fully grappling with. And I thought I was doing him a service by supporting him entirely in his version rather than challenging him. But in the end, I think I was holding him back from growing beyond it.
I'm talking with Ben Blum. He's the author of the book Ranger Games. It's an examination of a bank robbery that happened in South Tacoma in 2006. Ben's cousin Alex was involved in the robbery. Ben, you have these two conflicting stories about what that robbery was, about why and how it happened. And you set out to clear your cousin's name, but you ended up going back and challenging Alex on the places where his story didn't match up. Why?
I came to see the story that Alex had been telling for so long of his involvement as a kind of a cage that he had built for himself. It was such a radical breach in his sense of who he was to suddenly be a convicted violent felon and bank robber that he struggled terribly to figure out how to incorporate the story into his life story. And he arrived at a way of telling it that kind of worked or worked for a time. But I just, year after year, saw him retreat further and further into himself, saw him grow more and more embittered and resentful. And I came to see that as coming from the mismatch between this story that he'd been telling for so long and the more nuanced reality of what happened. I saw him kind of trapped by his inability to really own what he had done. So I came to view it as my duty, as someone close to him, as someone who loved him, to challenge him. It was one of the scariest things I've ever done, but it ended up being kind of transformational for both of us.
When you think about how scary it was to have to confront Alex with some of those holes, some of those untruths, I mean, what were those conversations like? I am imagining having uncomfortable conversations with my own family. I don't envy you.
I think it's something that everyone experiences in one way or another. You know, someone in our family like gets in a drunk driving accident or loses their job after an incident at work, or you know, any number of things that end up hurting the person who did wrong worse than anyone else. And it's someone you love. You want to help them. You want to support them. How do you support them while at the same time recognizing that they screwed up and they have something to learn from? And you know, there's this Buddhist notion that my father, practicing Buddhist, taught me years ago of idiot compassion, which just means basically enabling, providing unconditional love and approval for any form of behavior or neurotic impulse. And I just came to view what I had been practicing with Alex as a kind of idiot compassion.
I have to ask, why publish this? This sounds in many ways like a very intimate thing that you went through with Alex, and in some ways with Luke Sommer too. Why write a book about it? Why publish it?
It's a fair question. I think Alex's story is, in the end, a tribute to his courage and to our family's love for one another as we all grappled very imperfectly with this terribly traumatic event. I did at many times in this process consider abandoning the book and dropping the project. I came very close to doing so and probably would have if in the end I felt it didn't reflect the deep goodness that I saw at the core of Alex's character. I always saw the possibility of real goodness in him and felt so much goodness at every point in our journey. So, you know, I expect it to be disruptive and painful for a number of the people who are involved in it. And I am sorry for that pain, but I think it's a story worth telling. And I think in the end, our family can be proud of having wrestled as honestly and as we could with this like terrible event.
In the beginning of the book, you write really beautifully about sitting down with your uncle, with Alex's dad, and having lunch. I kept thinking about how he might react while reading this book. How does the rest of your family feel about this book?
Yeah. They've been incredibly supportive. I have gained an enormous appreciation over the course of working on this book for our aspects of our family culture that were not apparent to me growing up. You know, I thought these were all hard-ass jocks with no hearts. But that's not the case. There's an amazing amount of openness and warmth that I've discovered in our family that I didn't know existed before.
One of the things that struck me about your experience of Alex's story and trying to figure out what actually happened versus how Alex told the story of what happened was just this idea of the stories we tell ourselves about the things we do, how we sometimes spin things. How do you think about the stories you tell yourself now?
Yeah.
The decisions you make, the things you do, the way you talk about yourself to other people?
I feel a lot humbler than I used to. I think it's part of getting older, too. You start to recognize that, you know, the story you had about yourself when you were 25 completely fell apart, and the story you have about yourself now, it's probably going to fall apart, too. You know, why should it be any different? But I've also gained a real appreciation for the way we kind of build ourselves from the rubble of the old stories that fell apart around us, like that, the enormous value that there is in applying stories to reality. Reality is always too complicated to summarize in a story, but story is just the way that the brain has to get a grip on it. And you have to keep coming up with them. You have to keep making stories. So I love making stories, and I love learning other people's stories. And when a story shatters, it's just an opportunity for a new and better one to grow.
Jeannie Yandel talked with Ben Blum, author of Ranger Games, a story of soldiers, family, and an inexplicable crime. Tomorrow on this show, Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin. Ask her a question now on our Facebook page. Homelessness, crime, parking, housing, arresting protesters, taxing businesses. I'll put your questions to the mayor tomorrow on The Record.